Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, this is pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today we have BFM's very own Uma Pagan and PK Pagan.
Hello, Cam.
And we have the boss, the head honcho, the curator, the
festival director.
Festival director of the Georgetown Literary Festival, which is just finished. Also author of a brand new book, Once We Were Here. Once We Were There. Bernice Chorley.
We are.
And our three topics this week is, topic number one is how to create an arts festival. Topic number two is Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It. Mm-hmm. And finally, topic number three is false narratives. So with topic number one, how to create a festival, I have to do this topic because I have in this room the festival director of two different festivals. We have Uma Pagan of Kuala Lumpur.
Correct.
And we have Bernice Chorley of the Georgetown Literary Festival.
Correct.
Which just finished.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very big festival.
Mm-hmm.
There were like 60 participants.
Mm-hmm.
Over what, 3 days?
3 days, 55 events.
55 events. Day one was dedicated entirely to translations.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had panels mm-hmm. with many different authors from around the world over the next 2 days, and the panels were happening simultaneously.
And a Fringe, our very first Fringe, thanks to Uma and Hardish.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I got to ask, how to create a festival? I would like us to imagine that we're creating a festival out of nothing, and I want to follow the processes that you two have used, in order to create one. Let's imagine we're going to create the Subang Jaya Festival.
Sure.
Right?
It's funny you mentioned that, right? Because Bernice and I have been to a whole bunch of festivals all over the world. And mm-hmm. in most Western countries, festivals are all incredibly local.
Mm-hmm.
It's unlike the Singapore Literary Writers Festival. You know, it's unlike that. I mean, festivals are, there's the Richmond Book Fest, you know, and it kind of caters to the local audience who are all avid readers and curious about literature, and they cater to that, I guess, community, if you will. When we create festivals, and Bernice and I have to do it here, we're trying to bring in people from all over the world. Mm-hmm. We're trying to fly in interested people from Singapore who want to come and see. I mean, we're trying to draw in. It's the same with Singapore. When they do their Writers' Fest, they want to have an ASEAN appeal. So I'm glad you say Subang Jaya Festival because, you know, I think that's something we've never really explored in Malaysia. I mean, even the Johor Arts Festival is so targeted towards Singaporeans.
Yeah, yeah. There's a Stoke Newington Festival in London.
Right.
And that's sort of very community based as well, and you know, it's actually big authors coming to sort of like a suburb like Subang Jaya. So where do we start? We start with deciding what it is we want to do.
Uh-huh.
Who we want to target, how long, what sorts of events? Are you looking at children? Are you looking at, you know, teenagers? Are you looking at adults? Because it's very tricky when you try to combine you can't cater to everybody. That's impossible. And then you have an idea of you know, the timeline. Do you want to do it in the morning? Do you want to do it the whole day? Only in the evening? And then you start putting
in
some
sort of
ideas.
Very, very important logistical things.
Exactly. Where are you going to have it? What are the venues?
But do you fit the theme to the cast that you have available? If you have, for instance, a handful of, I don't know, authors, because it doesn't have to be just books, it can be whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And they all happen to do science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And these are just the people you know. Mm-hmm. Do you therefore create a science fiction
festival? Yes, why not?
You can if you want to.
If you want to.
Or you can just pull from the issues that are actually in science fiction. I mean, mm-hmm. I think when a festival tries to stick too much to a particular theme, you run the risk of alienating other audiences, right? So I think a lot of festivals, like even the ones we do, we have a general overarching theme, but we kind of bring in all these other things as well that may be loosely connected and in some ways not even connected at all, right? Because the theme is like our guiding ethos for that year, but it doesn't mean every single panel has to be about
exactly.
it.
But that would be true for you, Uma, with the Kuala Lumpur, because For you, Bernice, you're up in Georgetown. There is the Georgetown Festival.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, of course.
Yes.
So, and they do all
They do the visual arts and performance and music and film and you know, but we
photography,
stick... Photography, yeah. I mean, we stick...
So, therefore...
Yes.
literature,
yes,
you know, poetry. That's your thing. Whereas yep. you, Uma, you have the whole world of
but it's, ideas.
Yeah, it's a festival of ideas. Yeah. So it's quite
but it's
well.
Kind of rooted in literature in the sense that our speakers are usually authors because mm-hmm. we're trying to go for the purveyor of ideas, mm-hmm. right? So it's similar to what Bernice does, authors, filmmakers, musicians, mm-hmm. poets, mm-hmm. Thinkers, essentially.
Thinkers, right? Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So what is then, what are the individual events within your festival? What... So, for instance, with Georgetown Literary Festival, mm-hmm. you have panel discussions. Mm-hmm. So you'll have three, maybe four mm-hmm. Authors sit there. You have a moderator mm-hmm. and you have
a theme, a title
yes. for that particular mm-hmm. session. You talk around that. Mm-hmm. So that's one kind of event.
Yes.
But I think all the events that we do, whether it's a panel discussion, a poetry recital, a reading, a movie screening, mm-hmm. everything is kind of structured towards inciting conversation
yes.
and discourse.
It's got to be something that the audience is interested in, something that is very surprising and provocative and confronting as well, because the panels that we do have to be interesting for the writers themselves.
Oh, correct.
It's got to be something that they want to talk about. And, you know, this year we had a lot of panel discussions that were actually quite confronting. We were like, oh, Caliban? What are we going to talk about? Do I have to read The Tempest? Mm. You know, the whole panel on Medusa and Yakshini and Banshee. I mean, that was very, very popular because it was something that appealed to everybody. You know, the whole notion of superstition and the female yeah. as seductress. I mean, it's something that permeates all literatures around the world. So you have to have very interesting topics, things that sort of like hook you. You've got to have hooks. If you don't have hooks, it's not going to work. It's not going to be interesting to anybody.
Also, I'll say something very unpopular, which is, I guess, something we don't necessarily voice out loud, but it's something I'm sure Bernice, as well as myself, truly believe. A festival is not something, at least a program, is not something you can put together by committee. It is the vision of the festival director.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? You can't cater for everyone. You shouldn't try to cater for everyone. A lot of ways, it is in Kuala Lumpur, it is an amalgamation of all of the cultural things that I've been exposed mm-hmm. to over the year. And only yep. when a festival has a strong directorial vision mm-hmm. does it actually mean something.
Yeah.
Okay, well, El Presidentes. can I just say, with the Georgetown Literary Festival, there were 60-odd participants, and it's been going for, what, 7 years?
Yeah.
But in episode one, A New Hope, you had five.
Yes.
Didn't you? It starts with five people.
Yes, we had five. We had five, and Uma's been with us since the very beginning.
Since the very beginning.
Right. In fact, one episode you directed, didn't you?
That's right, when Bernice was away.
Yes, when I was away in Iowa finishing my novel.
That's The Phantom Menace. That's the one that no one watches. Yeah. But the point I'm getting at is that great things have small beginnings.
Oh, yes, and you have to start. You know, we have a tendency in Malaysia. Especially if it's like government-backed or something. Yeah. Everyone's like, big
besar,
one!
Besar, besta, masha. That boleh.
Got to grow it. And actually, what GTLF, what Bernice has done, is a great example of that, right? 5 to 65 in 7 years. It is about the right amount of time as well. If you speak to festival directors all over the world, they talk about that seven-year mark when suddenly everything starts coming together.
Right.
So the Subang Jaya Festival, can it be a great success?
Cam, it's all over to you.
All right. But you need an organizing person, don't you? I can follow orders. That's my job. I'm very good at that. Okay, so that's how you create a festival.
Uma, what's your favorite literary festival?
In the world?
In the world.
Well, obviously the Georgetown. Which is
other than Bernice's and mine. No, actually, my favorite one that it's an obvious choice. It's it's Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. But it's only because I love the vision of Nick Barley, the festival director.
Yeah.
He has fought hard to keep it the same size, even though they can get all the money they want. Right, they can make it as big as they want, but he knows that it's to cater for these people, and it's the he knows his audience, he knows who his target is, and he knows exactly what.
That's
he's
the
doing.
Edinburgh Literary Festival. Literary
the book festival. Okay. Yeah.
The book festival.
And you, Bernice?
Well, actually, I was in Edinburgh this year, and it's very good. But I think the one in The Hague, Ton van der Langtrouw's Literary Festival of Internachten, is also very, very, very good. It's a different scale altogether. Again, it's a lot more international. And Edinburgh is you know, I think there are a lot of writers that they also need to invite from the rest of the world. A lot of European writers, African writers. You know, they tend to go for the headliners. Mm-hmm. And I think it's nice to have, you know, sort of unknown writers, poets. But the best thing about Edinburgh is the yurt, the writer's yurt. And it's like the perfect green room. Right. You've got all these little sort of chambers. You've got like the sort of secret chamber where you only go into as you're about to get on, and then you can sit and drink wine and meet people like Komtoy Bean and Chimamanda Adichie and so on and so forth. So it's wonderful.
Well, at the Subang Jaya, we're going to specialize only in unknown writers and performers. Okay. So we must move on, though. And we're going to go on now to Spike Lee's brand new Netflix series, She's Gotta Have It.
Yes, I've been watching this for the last 2 days, actually, since I came up from Georgetown, because I wanted to just like watch something really sort of fun. And it's awesome. I mean, talk about female black power. My goodness. It's the acting is superb. It's great dialogue. It's so funny. I mean, he's come a long way from Do the Right Thing, which came out, I think, 20-odd years ago.
More than that.
Yeah. Sorry, maybe 30. 30 years
Over
ago.
Over 30 years ago,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, that's right. I remember watching it when I was a student in Canada. And that was absolutely shocking. You know, so brutal and so violent. And this one is sort of, I think he's matured in a way where he really looks at the issues of being black and issues of being about blackness in Brooklyn. So it's this very interesting community called Fort Greene. It centers around this female artist called Nola Darling, who's a very talented painter, and she's seen three men and a woman at the same time. So it's just really hilarious.
That one cannot. Delete.
No, but you know, it's obviously based on a movie he did, and now he's kind of adapted it into a TV series.
Yeah.
And I've only seen the first episode so far. And what I like about it is I think this is a great... I don't know if anyone else has done this themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are a lot of movies mm-hmm. that people turn into TV series.
Right,
more recently, like Rush Hour, Lethal Weapon. Mm-hmm. They're all right. They're not great. But this one is a creator himself going back, expanding these characters because you don't have the constraints of a two-hour runtime anymore.
Right, right. And there's so many little wonderful bits, you know. Like suddenly you have like a record, and like this is the track from the record. So it's like you're actually learning about music as well, and the montages for every episode are different. Characters introduce themselves. It's a really interesting kind of format. I've never seen anything like it.
Can
actually.
I ask though? Is it set up as just a 10 episode series and that's it? I do hope so. As opposed to there's going to be another 10 episodes.
I'm not sure.
Oh, that's a good question.
Sure.
I don't know. So much of this is based on the success of. Something, unless the creator has a very strong vision and I guess a strong point of view going, no, I want to tell my story in 10 episodes and no more. Mm.
Mm. See, what I find interesting with Spike Lee is I remember watching Do the Right Thing, that great summer riot
movie. Yes, that's right.
A movie that starts off seemingly as one genre and then just descends into mayhem and violence. Mm. And he was a young man and he was a young black director, very rare thing. Mm. And he took the world by storm, and it was really powerful stuff.
Yeah.
And yet, in recent years, he seems to have completely lost his way. I don't know if anyone watched Old Boy, which was his version of the South Korean film.
It was so bad. It was. I don't know. So for me, I kind of ignore Old Boy. You know what I think Old Boy was? I think Old Boy was Spike Lee going, man, that movie rocked. I really loved that movie. I want to make it.
Right.
I think that all directors do that, though. They go through the self-indulgent.
It's like an homage of sorts. You know, you want to see if you can emulate it and make it even better or something.
But can I just add, though, that with Old Boy, a bit of culture has a connection to that movie.
Yes.
Because
older
listeners may remember Shifa Situ. Mm-hmm. And she worked on that film.
Oh.
With Spike Lee.
She
really?
She came back saying, you've got to watch this film. Old Boy, it's going to be fantastic. And it was terrible.
I'm sure she had nothing to do with that. But, you know.
I mean, Malcolm X was good. I mean, I really did like Denzel Washington's.
So, Mike, the question I want to ask then is, therefore, Old Boy, which was, let's call it a white movie, but it was his version of a South Korean movie.
Yeah.
Therefore, should a director... an artist, stick with what they know.
Yeah, and I think Spike Lee is an auteur. He has that sort of vision of telling a particular story in a particular way. And this is why She's Gotta Have It works so well. I mean,
He's going back to familiar ground,
yes,
right?
Yes, but it's also unfamiliar because it's telling a story about black people in a completely different way.
So could we invite Spike Lee to direct the next Star Trek movie?
I don't think you could.
No.
And also, you know, the great thing about the Netflix series is it's 30 years or what later from the movie.
Right.
And of course, being black in America is completely different
changed,
now in 2017. So,
Has it?
Yeah. Although there was a character.
No, the issues are still the same. But what I mean is there is a lot more empowerment. You've had 8 years of an African American president. All of that kind of plays on the mind and on the narrative, right?
And we're in Trump's America as well.
America.
That's right. Absolutely. And the montage in this, I think in series episode 8 or whatever, is fantastic.
You've binged everything left.
Well, I still have two more to go.
It's a
really good watch. I mean, it's great. I'm really, really liking it.
So it's worth then perhaps going back to these old things and reimagining them as an expanded. Let me know if you went back to.
I think it depends on what it is.
is.
It depends on what it is. I mean, if it's doable, and if Netflix is willing to pump in X amount of, you know, million, because it's not a cheap production, yeah. It's really slick. It's really slick. Mm-hmm. And you've got these beautiful sort of like wooden floor apartments in Fort Greene in Brooklyn. I mean, like, you know, it's expensive, you know, to shoot in places like this.
Yeah. Okay. So she's got to have it.
She's got to have it.
Two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up. Yes.
Yeah. From you as well.
Totally. I've only seen one episode, but
it gets better, man.
I'm waiting for like a weekend where I can sit down and binge.
Okay. Okay. That's good. And in a moment, though, we're going to be asking about false narratives here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
And we're back with myself, Karen Roslan, Uma Pagan, MPK Pagan, and Bernice Chorley. And now, Uma, false narratives.
That is correct. And this is, of course, inspired by the recent Georgetown Literary Festival. So a couple of things. I mean, your theme in itself, Bernice, was monsters and immortals. Mm-hmm. And essentially, a lot of the stuff that was running through was about histories and narratives and dictators
and
democracies and myths and legends and all that stuff. The panel you had me hosting was with Sunny Liu, who wrote The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai, which was an alternative history of Singapore and Malaysia of sorts. And so there was this theme of false narrative that was running throughout the festival. And it got me thinking about what we believe and why we believe it. And for the most part, one of the big takeaways of it was, as long as the person speaking to you speaks with some authority and confidence in a manner that is very articulate, we are prone to believe that individual.
Uma, can you give a more concrete example of a person who talks a whole load of rubbish to convince people that something's true and it actually turned out to be not true?
So I may have done something as part of the Georgetown Literary Fringe in which I took a bunch of individuals.
It wasn't just a bunch. It was like 65
people.
Oh my goodness.
Many of whom were foreigners to our land.
Yes.
Yes.
On a tour of Georgetown by night. Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to be a tour of the seedy underbelly of Georgetown, which you've never seen or heard of before. It was false. It was all made up.
So about two hours of
walking around Georgetown, me telling them stories about Fort Cornwallis, about Love Lane, about Stewart Lane, about the Jewish family that lived there and ran this jewelry operation,
Fantastic.
Running the locals out of business and all of this stuff. And so here's the thing. I mean, that was the idea was, you know, to prove that point, right? You're at a literary festival and I've given you a false narrative. However, we are faced with that false narrative every day. So whenever a politician says something, whenever the media reports something, we have no idea, especially in Malaysia or I guess countries that are pseudo-dictatorial, whether we actually can believe that narrative.
Or not.
Yeah. And so for me, the question was, what do we do? Because we don't have the energy to verify and source check everything we hear. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, we kind of just accept it, unless it's something that is very close and personal to us and we know the true story, right? So this was my problem. Even as I was doing it, I was thinking, wow, I know, you know, I'm doing this as a bit of fun, but
you kept a straight face throughout. I mean, you just kind of went on spinning this yarn
straight
for about
throughout.
2 hours.
They were asking me questions.
Goodness.
I was answering the questions.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness.
Towards the end of the tour, there were these two ladies who came up to me and goes, hey, you know, it was really loud on Love Lane and we missed one part of the story. Could you just repeat it for us? And I was going, oh no. I was like, was it 14 years or 15 years? Was it 1962? What was the date that
so
I made
up? So you're literally
up?
Making it up on the spot.
I pretended like I had notes on my iPad so I could check as if I forgot stuff.
Oh my goodness.
And it was interesting. But what do we do, right? So in the face of this.
What do we do? Well, indeed, yeah.
And this is a problem you've had as well, right? Cam, you used to give this great KL walking tour.
Yes, this heritage walk, yeah.
Yeah, but I
No, it was real. Cam wasn't making stuff up.
It was real.
No. But the access to information, because the stories you told, yet again, run in contrast with, you know, our history books trying to wipe out Yap Aloy from existence and all of this stuff.
Yeah. The thing with Kuala Lumpur is, unlike Penang, the thing with Kuala Lumpur is that a lot of people live here, very few people either know the history or even stop to ask the history of the city in which they live.
Mm-hmm.
It's seemingly a featureless, unromantic, unhistorical town that is here and has always been.
Mm. Yes.
And hence this discussion, who created Kuala Lumpur, as if it was sitting there, and someone had a parang cut back the foliage, and there was Kuala Lumpur.
There it is, yes.
You know, and you do have to search. Takes effort to search in different places, and you're reading histories that were written in different times, mm-hmm. had different priorities. So if you read the colonial histories, I mean, they will talk about one person who now, when you read it, you won't find Frank Swetner mentioned at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could just go to Uma and he'll just make things up.
Yeah.
No, but speaking of making things up, that's what Sunny Liu did with Charlie Chan.
That's right.
And Sunny Liu is a very astute writer, incredible graphic artist.
Yeah, incredible.
And so suddenly when you read this book, you're like, hey, who is this Charlie Chan fella? Yes, everyone's Googling him.
Yeah, I thought it was real.
you did? Really?
Yeah.
But again, you know, because he wrote it with such authority, and you did mention this in your panel called Superman with Zunar as well, that you know people believed every single word of it.
Well,
because
why not? We're trusting. Well, why not? Why would a person make that up?
Because he or she is an artist. So this is the thing: are you a purveyor of truth, and what kind of truth is it? And whose truth is it? In Sunny's view, yes, it was a truth to him because this is how he sort of reimagined history. And there were bits of truths in it.
You've got to pepper it with just enough
truths. And then, but there's, you know, overarching sort of story, it's an alternative narrative.
I mean, I think that all sounds great. And it's like, whoa, the artist. But the problem is that we live in the Trumpian age where we're being bombarded by false narratives. Mm-hmm. And the thing that the false narratives that are coming out of Russia say want to achieve is not to say this is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to create an alternative truth.
Mm-hmm.
They want to undercut your ability to believe in any truth.
Mm.
And I do worry that
and that's the concern, right?
Well, yeah, and so the Sunny Liu's and the Uma Parkin, Ambike Parkins of this world who should feel bad because they are bad, it's just aiding that.
It becomes fiction, you see. Then it's fiction.
Well, fiction is different. But I mean, you present something as fiction. I mean, having said that, I've just written a book, which I guess just suddenly dawned on me.
No. But to be fair, you've presented it as fiction.
Yes.
So when someone picks up the book, they know it is fiction.
Yeah.
I presented it as
fact.
Complete fact and nonfiction, right?
But
that's the problem. In this day and age, you're getting that from one tweet at a time from the president himself of the United States, where everything he says is newsworthy and is gospel to a vast amount of Americans, Americans who don't question anything.
I know there's this guy who was interviewed on CNN just the other day, an American, a Trump supporter, and who's saying, you know, there's all this evidence being built up that Donald Trump has colluded with the Russians.
Yes.
And this guy says, despite all the evidence, even if, and he's a God-fearing Christian, even if Jesus Christ himself came down off the cross and said that Donald Trump is conspiring with the Russians, I would still have to say, he says, I've got to go speak to the president about this and see what he says.
Wow.
Trump
has superseded Jesus.
Yeah.
That is insanity.
Oh,
yeah. So
what do we do? How do we fix it? Well, I don't know.
All right,
I think the idea is to keep pointing it out to people and shocking them into realizing that not all of these narratives are real.
But the thing is, I mean, I still find on Facebook people who I respect still posting stuff which is clearly rubbish, which is coming is clearly just coming straight out of Russia. And I think that it's because people really want to believe this other narrative.
Because it's more exciting,
It's
right?
more exciting.
Yeah, but also, you know, in this crazy world, you just want to hang on to something that's going to give you a little bit of joy for like 10 minutes.
Yeah, if you eat 7 bananas a day, it'll cure your cancer. You know, that's the kind of stuff I see.
Well, I think also because they know that they've been lied to. They've been told, in fact, in the past that some politician, some source, respected source has lied to them, and then therefore it becomes a zero-sum game. Therefore, none of what they can say is true, and therefore the other side, everything they say is true.
Because if it comes from the top, a top that doesn't have, I guess, much credibility to begin with, why is it that we so easily believe that the CIA is up to no good? Because they've been up to so much no good in the past, that we're like, won't put it past them. They've killed lots of people. Yeah. So I guess when it comes from that level, we're just like, yeah, sure, okay, I believe that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think that you have an alternative job as a storyteller. There you go. I mean, you know, pulipular. I mean, not bad, you know, to be able to spin a yarn for 2 hours and have like, a, you know, the Pied Piper of Penang.
Yeah, so tired.
We must wrap this one up. Can I just ask, though, Uma, when you finally told these nice people.
Innocent people.
Innocent people that it was a lot of rubbish, how did they react?
Some of them called me names. But for the most part, they were shocked. There was genuine, like, jaws did drop. And then, wow. And then one of them called me a rude word. But he meant it lovingly, I'm sure. There was a poor lady who was training to be a tour guide who was taking notes throughout the 2 hours, who knew Penang better than me. Because I was like, we're going to Stewart Lane, she's like, well, actually, if you go that way, it's faster. And I was like, okay, thanks, you be my guide. So I felt really bad lying to her.
But they were
for the
entertained.
Most part, they were entertained.
Yes.
And they really enjoyed it. I think their guilt, one of them told me, this is uncle who was there, who just went, oh, I was really looking forward to telling my friends those stories.
Right. Well, in the immortal words of The Who, they won't be fooled again. So we must move on, though, to the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest, and I go first.
Mm-hmm.
Some of you out there in Radioland may know that I've become a big fan of South Korean movies recently.
Right.
Yeah.
Only recently?
Yeah, last few months. I mean, I've enjoyed them very much in the past, but yeah. I've suddenly just...
Oh, no, now he's obsessed.
Now I'm obsessed. I'm sorry. In fact, BFM's very own Caroline and I, we compare notes on this particular... But anyway, so I watched two particular... films directed by the same fella, Bong Joon-ho.
That's right.
Yes.
And I was completely blown away. He directed two films, one called Mother.
Mother is awesome.
Awesome. And Memories of Murder.
Mm-hmm. Both awesome.
I don't want to be alone with this anymore.
He wants to shout it out from the rooftop.
I want to shout it out from the rooftop. They completely just blew me away.
Yeah.
It was like discovering...
Crack cocaine.
That was very fast.
hey, she's just had weeks of sleepless nights planning a festival.
Right, I was about to say discovering a David Fincher or even a Coppola, I would say.
Mm.
As a director, you're watching it, this man really knows how to direct.
Oh, yeah.
He's framing things in a way that is so...
Great acting, man.
Especially in Memories of Murder, but it happens very suddenly. It's not like a whole thing, it's just a slugfest. So Memories of Murder and Mother, I'm just like, I'm speechless, I'm blown away. I think they're such great films.
Yeah.
And his guy directed Snowpiercer.
That's right. Yes, and more recently, right. Okja.
Yeah. I watched Snowpiercer. I liked it, but it's really not on my top.
But you're not a big hard sci-fi fan, though. Well, Star Wars isn't hard sci-fi.
Okay. All right. So anyway, so that's my recommendation. Joon Bong-ho, or is it Bong Joon-ho?
Bong Joon-ho,
whichever. And his... I've watched a lot of South Korean movies. I haven't worked out how the names work. And his two movies, Memories of Murder, fantastic, and Mother, which is astonishing. And so, Bernice.
Well, I'm recommending The Art of Charlie Chan Hok Chai by Sunny Liu, which is an extraordinary read. You can read it in 3 hours. I decided to sit down one Saturday a month ago and just went through it cover to cover.
We should tell people it's a graphic novel.
It's a graphic novel published by Epigram Books Singapore. It just won 3 Eisners at the San Diego Comic Con this year. It's absolutely extraordinary. It's one of the most incredible things I've ever read in my life. Sunny was at the Georgetown Literary Festival. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book. And would make the perfect Christmas present.
It really is. It's a monument, and you lift it up, and it's this epic achievement. It's quite awesome.
It's the great Singapore novel.
It is.
And it's witty. It's
funny.
It's fun.
It's sad. It's moving. It's so moving at the end. You know, when he talks about the country that was yet to be, I was like, oh my god.
Yeah. It's very human.
The layer upon layer. I mean, the layers. You know, and then how he portrays Dunku and sort of the, you know, when they're sort of negotiating independence and. Yeah, it's really a masterpiece. It's an absolute work of genius.
Yeah. And what's it called again?
Art of Charlie Chan Hok Chai by Sunny Liu.
Okay. And so, Uma, what's your recommendation?
I am recommending a new series on Netflix. It's called Godless. And it stars, I think Jeff Daniels might be the only person many people are familiar with, but it's about a Western town, which is primarily inhabited by women.
Michelle Dockery's in it.
Michelle Dockery's in it, correct. Okay, right. And it is a Western, in the classic American Western style. And think kind of Deadwood levels of violence and grit. And I'm a huge fan of Westerns, and I don't think we get enough of them. So because, you know,
Deadwood.
Yeah, because you know, Hollywood moved on, right? After a while, they realized, you know, we're done with this, just like how they're done with rom-coms now. Western had its day, so it's very rare that we get these. And this is an incredibly well thought out. I think it's 7 or 8 episodes long. You know, we live in a world right now where everything is kind of picked apart through a gendered lens. Mm-hmm. And I know someone was commenting saying, oh, you know, for a show that's about a town that's primarily populated by women, the women in the first episode have less speaking lines than men.
They had, and I can tell you what that figure is. It's 76% of the dialogue is spoken by men. And whatever makes 100 and the remainder 24 is done by women. And it's about a town made up entirely of women.
So there's a reason for that once you watch it, though. There's a reason for that in the sense that it feels a lot like those traditional Westerns, like Unforgiven and stuff. Mm-hmm. Those are the characters of the women. They don't speak so much. Everything is done through the kind of actions and stuff like that.
They don't speak so much.
Yeah, it's part of the characterization, though. I don't think it's a conscious effort to give them less lines.
Right.
And it works. I think
does it get better, though? I mean,
it's tremendous. Yeah, it's really, I'm in episode 5 at the moment, and I'm loving it.
On the Westworld scale of how's it?
Well, Westworld's very different. I mean, this is more of a traditional Western. Westworld's just, you know, sci-fi more than anything else.
So I just pick Westworld. But what is the peak series, binge series of recent times that's like?
Mindhunter was very,
Mindhunter
very,
was
good.
Very good. Yeah,
is that,
very,
is
very
that
good.
The yardstick?
There's
for,
so well, much binge worthy stuff.
Mad Men, then. Mad Men. That's on the Mad Men scale, where is it? Is it like a 10?
Oh, it's no Mad Men. It's no Breaking Bad, but it's just it's if you're a fan of Westerns, this is refreshing.
Okay, and that's Godless.
Godless.
Netflix. Netflix. So far, 10-part series?
I think it's 8 episodes long, if I'm not mistaken.
I like short things.
Yeah, I do as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I will check it out.
Yeah.
I will definitely check it out.
Yeah, I mean, I love Friends, 25 episodes, you know. That's fantastic.
Over a million years.
But I really like that 10 episode, 8 episode, 12 kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that brings us to the end of this week's show. And it only remains me now to thank special honored guest, Bernice Chorley.
Thank you.
Congratulations once again on having, one, finished the festival, and two, your book. How's your book doing?
It's doing great. Yeah. It's doing great. It won the Penang Monthly Book Prize.
Yeah. She's being modest. It's also going to be released in London soon. It's going to be a British edition.
A British edition, yes. Yes.
So it's Once We Were There by Bernice Chorley, available in all good bookshops.
Mm-hmm.
And Uma Pagan Ampakay Pagan.
Thank you very much, Cam. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. And myself, Cam Ruslan. And so please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
And now, an ad from Dad.
All right, save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive.
Can I take these off?
All right.
What is this? This looks good.
Wow,
that's well made.
Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.